From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. In 2000, George W. Bush became the first candidate to win the presidency without winning the popular vote since Benjamin Harrison in 1888. Many in Bush's position might have compromised, says our guest tonight, New York Post columnist John Podhoretz, but not Bush. He made the choice, said Podhoretz, to lead boldly, bravely, and decisively. Tonight on Point, the view from Bush country, John Podhoretz's case for George W. Bush's not good, but great presidency. But first, the implications of the widening U.S. trade deficit. The Department of Commerce revealed today that the trade deficit ballooned to a record $43 billion plus in January, giving Democrats an opportunity to criticize the Bush administration's trade policy and job creation. John Hilzenrath covers the economy for The Wall Street Journal and joins us now. John, put this monthly trade deficit number in perspective for us, if you would. What does it say about U.S. industry and the U.S. economy?
Well, it's important actually to look at what it says about the rest of the world. One of the reasons that the trade deficit widened was because our exports weren't growing as fast as they had been late last year.
In spite of the lower dollar.
In spite of the lower dollar, yeah. A lot of people in the Bush administration are counting on this lower dollar to help us. Our exports become more competitive overseas, and we were starting to see signs of that late last year, but it looks like it lost a little bit of steam in January. Part of that is a reflection of just how weak the economies are in Europe right now. And the other thing it says about the U.S. economy is that remarkably, consumers continue to spend money on imported goods despite the very sluggish job market.
Were there particular elements of the trade deficit in this month that stand out, or is it the same pattern? Huge imports from China. What else is going on to help this happen?
Well, the other thing that's going on, you mentioned the dollar, and there is a piece of that in here that kind of works counterintuitively. The imports, oil imports, the value of oil imports is rising because the price of oil is rising. And one of the reasons that the price of oil is rising is because OPEC members are not crazy about the fact that that the dollar has become so weak. The oil is traded globally in U.S. dollar terms.
So if the dollar is weaker, they want more of them.
That takes money out of their pockets. That gives them less incentive to crank up production when the economy is getting stronger. So in some ways, the weaker dollar is working against us, and we see that in the value of oil imports, which is working against the trade balance.
And John, what in these numbers is a legitimate target for Democratic criticism of the White House and GOP, as you see it, and what's not?
Well, it's very tricky. It's kind of strange how this connection between trade and jobs is being drawn, because there isn't a clear connection that you could draw over time. If you look at the trade deficit going back in the 1980s, we had a period of rising trade deficits, which got a lot of attention. But, of course, at that time, the economy was growing pretty robustly, and there were a lot of new jobs created during that period. Ironically, the last period that we had when the trade deficit was narrowing was in the early 90s, when we were experiencing a jobless recovery. And now we're in another period where the trade deficit is widening and we have no jobs. It's a pretty difficult connection to make. Now, the line that...
But the outsourcing issue is drawn in here. They say, well, of course, because all the jobs are going overseas, we're buying everything from there, everything's being made there, we have, a deficit and no jobs.
Well, yeah, and that's what a lot of people are pointing to. It looks like there's clearly outsourcing going on. A lot of it is concentrated in the manufacturing sector. A lot of manufactured products are now coming in from Asia, in particular China, and it would be hard to argue against the fact that the manufacturing sector has struggled a lot in the last year, in part because of import competition. This new wave that people are talking about on the services side of high-tech jobs going
call centers and all the rest,
it's kind of earlier stages, and it's a little bit harder to draw that connection. We actually have a trade surplus in services, and in fact, we have a surplus in services with India, despite the concern about India taking jobs away from the U.S. now.
John, as we head toward November and a vote, any sense of where this deficit's likely to go? If it continues to grow, it'll continue to be a big target in political conversation.
Well,
any indication?
I think the deficit is only going to be a target as long as the job market remains weak.
Yep.
And people are looking for explanations for why the job market is so weak. I mean, trade is probably a piece of it, mostly on the manufacturing side, but there are a lot of other things going on that are causing the job market to remain so weak. I think that's really where the attention is going to continue for a long time. For at least the next few months, even if we have a couple of good months of job growth, it's going to be hard for the Bush administration to stand up and argue that many jobs were created on its watch. Of course, its argument is going to be that it inherited a pretty weak economy, and it can't be held totally accountable. Well, they would say they couldn't be held at all accountable for the weak pace of job growth. Of course, there's going to be a little bit of truth in both sides, but there's going to be a lot of fuzziness in the process.
In the meantime, anything related to the absence of jobs is going to get a lot of attention, and not least to trade deficit numbers. John Hilzenrath, thanks so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you.
John Hilzenrath covers the economy for the Wall Street Journal. He spoke with us from New York. Here's the view. George W. Bush led America through the crisis of 9/11 and two wars ambitiously and unwaveringly. He is unrelenting in his fight for the freedom and security of the American people. He is not a good, but a great president, says our guest tonight, conservative columnist and former Reagan speechwriter John Podhoretz. Podhoretz has a drastically different view of George Bush than liberal pundits Molly Ivins, Al Franken, Michael Moore, and company. Bush is no cowboy, no imperialist, no shrub, Podhoretz says. And it's Bush's successes over the past 3 years, he claims, that have put liberal critics on the warpath. Tonight on Point, John Podhoretz's point-by-point defense of George W. Bush. Do you see the successes of the Bush presidency or the shortcomings? Why is George Bush so often seen as either great or god-awful? Why is he so polarizing? 3 years in, what do you make of the man in the White House? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from New York is John Podhoretz, columnist for the New York Post. He is a co-founder of the Weekly Standard and served as a speechwriter for President Ronald Reagan. His new book is Bush Country, How W. Became a Great President While Driving Liberals Insane. Good evening and welcome, John Podhoretz.
Good evening.
Thanks for being with us. John Podhoretz, give us the heart of your argument. Good, great, not good, you're saying.
The heart of my argument is that challenged as few presidents, indeed world leaders, have ever been challenged in the aftermath of the worst terrorist attack ever staged on this earth. George W. Bush fashioned a radical and important foreign policy that not only aggressively attacks the terrorists at the source and the nations that harbor them, but also lays out the groundwork for a victory in a decades-long war on terror, which involves the transformation of Arab and Islamic countries from the fiefdoms, autarchies, and slave states that they are now into states with democratic institutions that provide their people with the freedoms and liberties that will allow them to express themselves in a way that is not destructive and that is not threatening to the United States and to the West.
John Podhoretz, you describe George W. Bush, President Bush, as a riverboat gambler, and the kind of riverboat gambler that you like. What do you mean by that?
Well, a lot of this has to do with the strategy and tactics that he uses as a politician and as a political leader. In almost a startling reversal of the habits and styles of Bill Clinton, who was a very cautious politician but a very reckless person in his personal life and in the way he pursued his own personal interests, George W. Bush is a very cautious and careful and controlled person in his personal life, but in But when it comes to attempting to cast a large shadow on the political scene here in the United States and abroad, his method is to bet big, is to make proposals that are extraordinarily ambitious, far more ambitious than anybody would have expected him to make, and then to attempt through this ambition and through his refusal to back off of his ambitious stance to force his adversaries to come toward him, at which point he can then compromise and get, you know, 2/3, 3/4 of what he wants. And, you know, a lot of what makes a leader successful is whether or not he can exercise his leadership, whether or not he is effective at using the tools of power. And George W. Bush has proved himself astonishingly effective, particularly for someone who came to office with no electoral mandate, having lost the popular vote and having assumed office under very troubling and difficult circumstances that would have led anyone rationally to expect that he would be a very compromised leader who would not really be able to get very much done and would have to sue for peace, essentially from his adversaries. And he adopted a very different and surprisingly successful approach. Mm.
So you've got this provocative subtitle, very much in the tenor of the times, from both left and right. I don't know if the publisher said, let's put a flaming torch out front here, but you've got it. You say how W became a great president while driving liberals insane. I guess there's a few points on which he's made some conservatives pretty uneasy as well.
In recent months.
But on the liberal side, what is your explanation for why liberals are so publicly, unapologetically bust out mad, you say insane or crazy, about George Bush?
Well, I think a lot of it stems from the circumstances of the 2000 election. I think that liberals and Democrats were and remain honestly and with some reason, you know, angered and outraged by the result, and don't like it and believe that he assumed office to some degree illegitimately. Combine that fact with the way that he has strode the narrow world like a colossus, how he has sort of exerted his leadership and his authority without reference to the troubling circumstances of his arrival in Washington, and without acting as though he were damaged and illegitimate, and pursuing, you know, into some degree a very unashamedly conservative agenda, particularly in the realm of the economy with tax cuts.
Is this good or is this impudent, impertinent, unaware that he slipped in by a fingernail and the Supreme Court's fingernail?
Well, it's neither impertinent nor impudent. It is what we expect of leadership. It would make no sense whatsoever for someone to assume office and presume that he was not elected to do things. That is what his adversaries would wish of him, that he would not act in accordance with his beliefs, in accordance with his principles, and to do as president what he said he would do as candidate. But that is pretty much what he's done.
You say
he won the presidency according to every way that we determined that the presidency was won, which is say you can say that the Supreme Court put him in office, but you know, a year-long recount of votes by USA Today said that if there had been a statewide recount in Florida, he would have prevailed in Florida in any case.
Well, but the Supreme Court did it. But
it doesn't matter whether the Supreme Court did it or not. He is president of the United States.
It's just history. That's
he
all
is
I'm
sworn
pointing
into.
To. Yeah.
Well, no, but I mean that the problem. Yes, I believe that they think that he isn't that he was impudent, that he is arrogant, and that he has done more and attempted to do more than was his right to do, and that opinion, the cognitive dissonance, which is that they think he should not be an effective president, and they have very little respect for him as a person or as a as a thinker, as a doer, as an actor, and yet here he is.
Here he is,
having changed America and the world.
We've got to take a short break. We're talking with John Podhoretz. His new book is Bush Country: How W. Became a Great President While Driving Liberals Insane. You can join the conversation 3 years in. What do you make of the man in the White House? Why is George Bush seen as either great or god-awful? Why is he so polarizing? Why does the president drive liberals so crazy? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're hearing tonight the case for George Bush, not as a good president, but as a great president. In the words of John Podhoretz, not a moron, not a puppet, not a liar or a cowboy, but a hero. His new book is Bush Country: How W. Became a Great President While Driving Liberals Insane. You can join the conversation tonight. Have opponents missed the point of George Bush, or have they seen it too clearly? Can such a divisive president be a great president? And who's got it right, Molly Ivins or John Podhoretz? Is it Little Shrub or Bush the Colossus? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. John Podhoretz, you take up what you present as the kind of liberal laments against George Bush. And the first one you take up, Chapter 1, Bush is a moron. You say, no way.
Well, I think it has been a great help to George W. Bush that his adversaries have contempt for him rather than proper respect and fear, because they consistently, as he famously malapropped, misunderestimate him.
Right.
They do not. They see his style, which is very much not the style of the chattering classes of the Northeast. Lots of references to popular culture, easy irony, mm-hmm. lots of knowing humor. The fact that he does not possess that style and does not wear his education or his learning, much at all, but rather takes a different, much more self-deprecating, aw shucks, kick the earth, you know, back-slapping, golf-playing mm-hmm. style, that connotes stupidity, lack of intellectual curiosity, and a genuine lack of roundedness or sophistication to them. And this is a foolish thing to think about somebody who, after all, only achieved elective office in 1994, beating a sitting popular governor in Texas
yep.
in a landslide, and then 6 years later became president of the United States. There has never been a political rise as meteoric, and there has rarely been a presidency as dramatically effective in its first 3 years in terms of getting legislation passed, in terms of exerting his will on America and the world. Mm-hmm. And the person who does that is not a fool and not a moron. And to think that he is not only to do, you know, to do him an injustice, but to do yourself an injustice failing to take the adequate yeah. measure of the person who is your adversary.
You've got to say, whatever you make of George Bush, he has come on like gangbusters, as you say. You make some interesting connections between that style that George Bush presents in and his youth, his embrace of the Texas persona. And you point to one famous incident in particular at Yale where he took what he felt as a real slap in the face, that you say in this complicated relationship he has with his father and his origins, put him back into that Texas posture. Can you relate that for us, John?
Sure. Well, he was 18 years old. The year was 1964. He was a freshman at Yale. He had just returned from Texas, where his father had lost a painful election to a man named Ralph Yarbrough. He was on the campus of Yale, and he spotted across the way the chaplain of Yale, a famous figure there who was soon to become much more famous as a sort of hero of the counterculture, William Sloan Coffin.
Mm-hmm.
He knew that Coffin had been at Yale with his father, and so he went up to him and introduced himself, and he said, "Reverend Coffin, I'm George Bush."
Mm-hmm.
And Coffin said to him, "Oh, yes, I knew your father. Frankly, he was beaten by a better man." And his family, to a man, describes this as a traumatic experience, which I think any of us can understand, that you're 18 years old, a remarkable authority figure on your college
campus.
Have
William Sloan Coffin look you in the eye and said, your father deserved to lose. He was beaten
exactly.
by a better man.
Exactly. And, of course, you have no recourse. You're 18 years old. You can't fight back. You can't punch him in the face.
But it turns out he did have recourse over the longer term.
That's right. But the point that I make in the book is that this was a hinge moment in his life because, of course, though he grew up in Texas, he was a child of Connecticut. He was born in New Haven when his parents were at when his father was at college finishing up. His mother was from Connecticut. Her father was an investment banker. His father's father had been a senator. And, you know, he could just as easily have gone east, stayed east, gone to become a banker or a lawyer, you know, and lived his life that way. That was one of the options open to him. And instead, I believe at that moment, and a lot of people believe at that moment, he said, "The hell with this. If this is what it means to be an Easterner, I want no part of it." And he went back to Texas every summer after school. He moved there when college was over, and a Texan he has remained.
John Podoritz, you know how fathers and sons can work and things that come down and don't come down in families. We spoke to your father, Norman Podoritz, on this show.
Yes, we did. It was a lovely interview. Thank you very much.
But you must also, I wonder how you look out at the world and so unflinchingly make this assessment. I mean, you know, there are American liberals who are upset, but it's not only Americans. Reading the New York Times just a couple of weeks ago, review of this huge list of books written with absolute hand-wringing and despair and fury about George Bush, the conclusion being, you know, looking abroad, the author was taken back. He says, "To have my country depicted page after page, book after book, as a dangerous empire in its last throes, as a failure of democracy, as militaristic, violent, hegemonic, evil, callous, arrogant, imperial, and cruel. If George Bush is so good, why do so many people come to those kinds of conclusions?"
Well, I believe that there is a great deal of intellectual corruption in the assessment of him. I think that he has proved that there is a way to be a strong and a potent leader that actually is an answer and a rebuke to the style, the prevailing style that the international community believes in, which is to try to desperately seek consensus, to use international, to allow international organizations to have the final say, not to, you know, to essentially hide America's light under a bushel when its light is too bright because it's just too powerful.
But if the light, the way Bush exposes it, earns that response, is that all in the eye of the beholder? And if the rest of the world's got it wrong, how good is that? Oh, all right. But
it's not the rest of the world, Tom. What is being quoted? No, but what is being quoted in those books, this is exactly like it was in the 1980s when Ronald Reagan was president of the United States and much of the European intelligentsia considered him a cowboy and a dangerous person who was going to bring about a nuclear war. Instead of bringing about a nuclear war, he brought about the collapse of the Soviet Union. They were wrong about him. He was right. The European intelligentsia that speaks this way about Bush is wrong about Bush, and he is right. And just because they are foolish enough and corrupt enough to adopt an attitude toward him that is frankly ignorant, I mean, much of the opinionizing about Bush is ignorant. For example, the assertion that he is a religious fanatic when in fact he is a follower of a completely mainstream strain in American religious belief. He's a Methodist. He reads a Tyndale page a day Bible. He attends Bible study.
There's no question that religion is very important in his life and that it was pivotal in his life about, what, a decade, a dozen years ago?
About 15 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Or 17, 18 years ago.
But you're not saying that didn't happen, that wasn't a kind of come to Jesus moment of importance for George Bush.
Yes, it was. And it is. And it is for tens, if not hundreds of millions of Americans in whose likeness he is and whom he represents. If that is something that is disgusting and appalling to Europeans who believe in a much more secularized leadership.
And a lot of Americans raising that complaint and concern as well. John Podoritz, stand by. There's a lot more I want to touch on here, but we've got a lot of callers who want to join us, and I want to invite them in. Kyle is calling from Raleigh, North Carolina. Hi, Kyle. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm so glad you've got this debate going. It's a very emotional issue, and I'd like to think that I'm pretty level-headed about it.
All right.
I think Bush is a great guy. I really do. But I think he's not a great president. I mean, he's a guy like me and you, a guy I'd like to hang out with. But you know what? Mm. Guys like me and you really don't make good presidents. And if he was such a great president, as your guest is saying, why are we still having all these problems? I mean, we would have won the war on terror. We would not have suffered a recession. We wouldn't have such a huge deficit in the economy. I mean, we would be doing much better. Bush would not have to be saying all these excuses. Well, you know, we'd be doing better, but we've suffered, you know, a recession. We've had an attack.
So you're saying, just objectively, Kyle, when you look out at the world, you don't see a world shaped by, if he was so great, it would look better, you're saying?
I'm saying a great president would handle not only the war on terror, but also all the domestic issues that we're faced with right now. And we're suffering at the expense of the war on terror, and our president seems to have tunnel vision over this. I mean, we were all attacked, not just Bush.
Kyle, stand by. John Podhoretz?
Well, I mean, I understand what the caller is saying, but there are so many misrepresentations of fact in what he says that it's a little head-spinning. I mean, first of all, the economy, he inherited a recession. The economy went into recession, according to the National Bureau for Economic Research, a private firm that is considered a group that is considered the arbiter of recession 6 weeks after he took office. 6 weeks, March 1st, 2001.
Nobody argues
that. He did
that.
Not bring the economy into recession. The economy now is growing at a rate of around 4 to 4.5% a year. That is the fastest growth rate in 20 years.
And grew 8-something percent late last year, but still about those
no,
jobs?
No, the unemployment rate is 5.6%.
But let's not gloss that. You know, a lot of people have just dropped out of the job market at this
well,
point.
Well, no, that is always true of the unemployment rate. And in 1996,
it's not always equally
no
true.
There is no gloss. In 1996, when Bill Clinton was running for president in March of 1996, the unemployment rate was 5.6%. And Bill Clinton ran as a president governing a country that was in economic recovery, as the United States is, in a roaring economic recovery. And I think an interesting thing has happened where the unemployment number, which used to be how we gauged Americans' feelings about jobs and how they were working, has somehow magically and mystically been replaced by a jobs creation number. And you know why? Because the jobs creation number is bad and the unemployment number is good. The unemployment number has gone down 0.8 percentage point in
But it's not just that. There have been other times when we had growth at this rate, but also jobs growth, and now we don't.
Right. But as you were discussing with
Kyle,
the Wall Street Journal reporter at the top of the hour, you know, much of the reason that we don't have job growth are the results of systemic changes in the economy, in productivity increases, in globalization, things that the president of the United States has almost no authority over, and indeed from which we benefit in terms of economic growth. And remember, a 5.6% unemployment rate means that 94.4% of the American people who want jobs have jobs.
Yeah,
that is what the number means. If
sure.
you want to spin it around. And according to the Household Employment Survey, another survey done by the Bureau of Labor Statistics, just like the unemployment survey, 138.1 Americans are now working. That is the highest number ever in history. So this picture is much different from this idea that we're in terrible and deep economic trouble. Now, in terms of the war on terror,
all right,
the war on terror cannot be won in 3 years. It's 2.5 years since September 11th. One of the things that we know about what's happened is that the horrible tragedy today in Madrid is the first assault on a Western country since September 11th. Now, if you had told anybody on September 12th, 2001, that the United States would go 2.5 years without being hit again, we all would have thought that was crazy. Everyone presumed that there was going to be another terrorist attack or two. It hasn't happened. That is a success of the war on terror. One of the things that it means is that untold Americans are alive today who would not otherwise have been had we not taken an aggressive stance in that war.
Listeners, everything's coming up roses here with John Podhoretz, author of the new book, Bush Country. We've got the view from Bush Country tonight. Kyle, thanks for your call from North Carolina. Anthony is calling from Providence, Rhode Island. Hi, Anthony. You're on the air.
Hi, how are you tonight?
Great, thanks.
I'd like to ask Mr. Podhoretz to respond to Paul O'Neill's book about his time in the Bush administration. A couple of points from Mr. O'Neill's book. First, he says, well, in the way that he describes the way that policy gets formed and carried out, that, well, Dick Cheney is our de facto president. But from there, he says that it was his experience through watching how policy was formed and debated and, you know, carried through to Congress, that this administration that they work toward, you know, gaining political ends, that policy is constructed with politics in mind. Now, of course,
everybody does that, don't they, Anthony?
It's always constructed with, yep. Let me finish.
Yep.
Policy is always constructed with politics in mind, but what O'Neill is saying is that that is the most important thing for this administration, that whether policy is good or not is a very much a secondary concern for the Bush administration. And does Mr. Potharetz, in tackling this, you know, do great presidential administrations and great presidents go about creating policy in this way, or would he just reject what O'Neill, who was a guy who was there for some time in the administration, would he just reject outright what Paul O'Neill is saying?
Anthony, let us pick those up. John Podhoretz, it goes really to two accusations that you've got right here in your chapter heads. Bush is a fanatic, and maybe Bush is a puppet. You say no and no.
Well, first of all, in relation to Paul O'Neill was fired by the Bush administration in a publicly humiliating, you know, act for him, a CEO who, by many reckonings, was the worst Treasury Secretary in 100 years, somebody who spent much of his first year in office redesigning the Treasury Department's offices to make them conform to his idea of what offices should look like. And his portrait of the Bush administration bears very little relation to the Bush administration that actually has had its effect on the world. His portrait of it would suggest that the Bush administration never got anything done, could never do anything, that Bush was ineffectual, that he had no sort of gumption, that he was servile to his aides and bored by policy. Whereas, in fact, Bush, when he gets on an issue, will talk it and talk it and talk it and talk it for months and say exactly what it is that he wants to say over and over and over and over again, pushing his agenda forward and forward and forward in a way that would be exhausting and boring and difficult for most of us, something that he masters and a political technique that he mastered in Texas to force his will upon a recalcitrant country. That is not an ineffectual president. And as far as doing things for political ends, to some degree, of course, he does things for political ends. But I think it would be very fair to say that if you look at his agenda as president, it has conformed very precisely to what he said he was going to do as a political candidate. Does he believe that the things that he did, that he stands for as a political candidate and as a president, are in the best interest of the country? Absolutely, he believes it. O'Neill may not believe it, and he has made some, you know, he has made some compromises that I don't like. He signed the campaign finance reform bill, which I think is a constitutional atrocity. You know, he compromised terribly on the education bill, which I think, you know, has become a sort of muddled mess. But, you know, presidents disappoint us and they don't do everything that we want them to do. But I think for the most part, he has been remarkably straightforward about his ambitions and he has been remarkably sort of guided by his sense of what would be best for the country.
John Podhoretz, we've got to take a break. John Podhoretz has no doubt about the consequence of this administration. He says George W. Bush will face the American people as a candidate for re-election, having constructed one of the most consequential presidents in the nation's history. To what end? What do you think? Has the president made America Bush country, whether opponents like it or not? Or is he headed for a fall in November? And what's the profile? Who loves Bush? Who hates Bush? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We are hearing tonight the case for George Bush, not as a good president, but as a great president. In the words of John Podhoretz, our guest, not a moron, not a puppet, not a liar or a cowboy, but a hero. His new book is Bush Country, How W. Became a Great President While Driving Liberals Insane. You can join the conversation. Why is George Bush seen as either great or god-awful? Why is he so polarizing? Have opponents missed the point of George Bush, or have they seen it too clearly? Has George Bush captured the American soul and spirit, in John Podhoretz's words? To what end? And what will history's judgment be on George W. Bush? We're at 1-800-423-8255. Jim is calling from Gaylord, Michigan. Hi, Jim. You're on the air.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
You asked the question, how can he be so polarizing and yet still be considered great? I think the very thing that makes him great is what makes him so polarizing. On several issues, the exact same thing that those who think he's great see is the exact same thing that his detractors see that make him so horrible. The moral clarity, the reliance on faith, the simple willingness to act when you see wrong. These are all things that admirers see and say, thank God that someone is finally ready to step up and do, while his detractors say, oh my God, how can you possibly do that?
Jim, let me ask you, Bill Clinton was also very polarizing from a different angle. Does that qualify him as great as well?
In my opinion, not really, because what he was admired for and what he was reviled for were very different. The things that made Bill Clinton so admired by his admirers was the fact that he saw no black and white. Everything was gray. Everything was shaded. The same thing goes for Bush, except that he sees very little gray. There's so much good, but there's also so much that is actually evil. And evil is not something that sits well with liberals, because that means that you're making a judgment. And as we all know, liberals can't judge anyone.
Jim, we got it. Thank you for your call. John Podhoretz, how about it? Is there a point at which presidential polarizing quality or divisiveness has to be countered against a president or not?
Absolutely not. I mean, if you think about some of the most important decisions made by presidents, you know, in American history, they have often come in the teeth of very great polarization. Think about the reinstitution of the draft in 1941, done by one vote in the House of Representatives. You can think about the election of 1948, Harry Truman having essentially begun the Cold War, having been sort of attacked from his right by Thomas Dewey, ended up, you know, winning in this incredibly narrow, incredibly difficult election. It is very easy to be a leader when you have a massive majority behind you, and when you have all, you know, when you have everything going your way. The question is, how do you function as a leader when you actually have to represent the interests of a country, when a lot of people in your country disagree with you?
But Jim suggests that he gets this stature by being a kind of moral clarion. You point out that not everybody sees it that way. You quote from the San Francisco Chronicle, Harley Sorensen, describing President Bush as, and this is tough language, but describing him, referring to his former history of drinking, as a dry drunk. He says, a dry drunk in simplest terms is someone who doesn't drink but still retains many of the characteristics of a drinking alcoholic. And he goes on to say that Bush displays exaggerated self-importance and pomposity, grandiose behavior, a rigid judgmental outlook, impatience, childish behavior, irresponsible behavior, irrational rationalization, projection, and overreaction. This is a description of divisiveness, not from because he's a moral clarion, but something quite different.
Well, it is, and it's a repulsive thing to say, and I quote it as an example of precisely the kind of insanity to which his liberal or leftist critics are descend to. I mean, think about it right now. What he has described as an overreaction is what Sorensen describes there is somebody who saw the attacks of September 11th, said this will not stand, said that we will draw no distinctions between the terrorists and the states that harbor them. And a month later, this country went to war in Afghanistan, dethroned the Taliban regime, sent al-Qaeda on the run, arrested 600 of its most vicious fighters, has killed or captured 60% of its leadership. And right now, today, we see an offshoot of al-Qaeda possibly having now killed and wounded 1,200 people in Madrid. Those are evil people.
What does that add up to? To success or not? Or, I mean, Afghanistan
no,
is
what
still
it adds
roiling?
Up to, what it adds up to is George W. Bush looked at al-Qaeda, looked at what happened on September 11th and said, this is evil. We are fighting it. There is no middle ground. You are with us or you are with them. That is precisely the kind of moral clarity that the caller discussed, and I agree with him. And that is precisely the kind of moral clarity that Harley Sorensen in that quote finds as an overreaction and an act of moralism, you know, moralizing. And if that is the sort of thing that he thinks, and that is the sort of thing that Bush's critics think, then they are then they are not only doing him an injustice, but it's one of the reasons that people like me believe that they that at a time of great peril to the United States and to the world, you know, it is dangerous to think about having them with the reins of office.
The language gets very heated. People are really upset. As you point out, the idea that's out there is goes in many directions. One of your chapters raises this one, says, Bush is Hitler, only not as talented as what you call crazy liberal idea number four. You quote CIA official Ray McGovern on the Iraq War saying, Joseph Goebbels had this dictum, if you say something enough, the people will believe it. I think we all ought to be worried about fascism in the United States. He's talking there in relationship to the line of argument that took the country into the Iraq War. You describe this as another example of opponents of Bush going around the bend.
Well, it is, obviously, to describe this country as becoming fascistic when, you know, there's going to be an election in November and the supposed fascist dictator will, you know, could easily be voted out because of people like Ray McGovern and people who think like him, convincing a majority of the American people to go along with them and their decisions. I mean, that the polls right now show, you know, a split, evenly divided country. It could go either way. And under those circumstances, the notion of describing the president of the United States as a Hitler-like fascist is nothing short of absurd. And of course, it is also a repugnant overstatement. It is not enough to say that you don't like Bush. You think his policies toward Iraq are bad or bad for the country or bad for the world, but that you have to start comparing people to murderers of 6 million Jews. That is not acceptable. That is beyond the bounds of rational discourse.
John Podoretz, you describe George Bush in his own words. He says he doesn't want to go after policies of small ball. He's a risk taker. He sets extraordinarily far-reaching goals. If George Bush gets a second term, do you expect him to be as ambitious in the terms that you describe here in a second term as he has been, in your view, in the first?
Well, I mean, there is one element of his of the agenda that he laid out for himself in the 2000 campaign that he has not really addressed much in this first term, and that is Social Security reform. I mean, he's done Medicare reform with his prescription drug benefit bill, which has some Medicare reform in it. If he manages a second term by really putting Social Security reform on the front burner of the United States, the way that Ronald Reagan, for example, in his second term, put tax reform on the front burner, that will be a remarkable accomplishment and a real advance in terms of, you know, pulling the debate in yet another direction that the country needs to go.
John Podoretz, with that, we are out of time, but we thank you for joining us tonight.
Thank you so much.
John Podoretz joined us from New York. He's a columnist for the New York Post, co-founder of the Weekly Standard. His new book is Bush Country, How W. Became a Great President While Driving Liberals Insane. You can continue this conversation online. Go to onepointradio.org and click on forums. In a moment, the gay marriage debate picks up again in the Massachusetts legislature. This is On Point. The national battle over gay marriage returned to Massachusetts today, where a high court ruling is scheduled to become legal as of May 17th. Today, the state legislature preliminarily passed a constitutional amendment defining marriage as the union of one man and one woman. The amendment moved today still needs to pass another legislative vote during the current constitutional convention and yet another next year before it would be put to Massachusetts voters for a final decision that would be years away. The Massachusetts High Court has ruled in November that the state must begin recognizing gay marriage in May. That ruling launched a wave of responses nationally, including President Bush's call for an amendment to the U.S. Constitution banning same-sex marriage. California's Supreme Court today ordered an immediate halt to gay marriages being performed in San Francisco. WBUR's Fred Tice is at the Massachusetts State House in Boston, and he joins us now with the latest. Good evening, Fred.
Good evening, Tom.
So where do things stand there? There's this confusing ball of parliamentary legislative steps. What exactly has happened at this point today?
Indeed. Up just a few minutes ago, the entire debate ever since this constitutional convention got underway last month has been over the language that legislators would adopt regarding gay marriage. So they've been arguing over, well, if we pass something, what is it going to say? Well, a few minutes ago, they decided what it's going to say by an overwhelming majority, 136-62. They decided to pass the language of a measure that would ban gay marriage and at the same time establish civil unions with all the rights of marriage.
And is there another step in this during this current conclave, Fred, or is this what's coming out now?
You bet there's another step. They are in a brief recess now. They're coming back in just a few minutes. And if they vote to go beyond 9 o'clock Eastern time, then we will see a debate tonight on up or down on this measure that they've just crafted, whether to vote yes or no on this measure that bans gay marriage and at the same time establishes civil unions with all the rights of marriage.
Fred, we know how tricky the politics of the Massachusetts legislature can be. Does the fact that it's had this preliminary passage here with the ban on gay marriage, the permission of civil unions, does that mean that it necessarily has a majority if it comes back for a vote?
It does not necessarily mean that, Tom. It's a good point that you've picked up on, because there are a lot of supporters of same-sex marriage in the legislature, as many as 60, depending on how you look at the votes. And they have been vote switching. Many of them supported the language of this measure here that bans gay marriage but establishes civil unions with full rights of marriage in order to prevent anybody else through parliamentary procedure from introducing their own proposals, to block out any other proposals that supporters of same-sex marriage would view as even more detrimental. What we may see now, mm-hmm. we're likely to see in just a few minutes, is a big reversal of votes. The question is whether the liberals, the supporters of same-sex marriage, have enough votes to switch later on this evening and thereby kill any proposal from coming out of this constitutional convention this year.
So a kind of strategic legislative backflip where they put up the ban on gay marriage and the establishment of civil unions, but then in the vote that really counts might flip back the other way, vote against it, which would leave Massachusetts with A, gay marriage becoming legal as of May 17th, and no constitutional amendment on the rails.
Absolutely. And so the big question is just how many people can they count on here? By my vote count, it was about 30 votes that are likely to switch. And so we're likely to see tonight, if they continue debating tonight and indeed take another vote tonight, we're likely to see this measure pass the Massachusetts legislature for this evening at any rate. And that measure would ban gay marriage and at the same time establish civil unions. Now, under the parliamentary procedures of Massachusetts, even if it passes tonight, then it has to be considered a third time, because every proposal before the legislature must be considered three times. And then the debate starts all over again, either probably at a later date, sometime later in this legislative session. So long from over.
Fred, for our listeners around the country, as of May 17th, gay marriage will be legal. Is that right, under the Massachusetts High Court ruling?
That's correct.
And nothing happening here today or in the immediate future is going to stop or change that. So what happens to marriages that are performed from May 17th forward until when and if something is changed in the Constitution?
If the legislature passes this measure and it goes to next year, to the next legislative session, and it passes there, and if voters in 2006 pass this measure at the ballot box that would ban gay marriage and at the same time establish civil unions with all the rights of marriage, it leaves open a big question. It does not answer this question as to what will happen to all the folks who got married, the same-sex couples who got married between May 17th of this year and November of 2006.
Well, it's a national debate and a state focus tonight. Fred Tice, thanks very much for joining us.
You're welcome, Tom.
Fred Tice is covering the Massachusetts Constitutional Convention for WBUR. On Point is produced by Meghna Chakrabarty, Eileen Amata, Julie Jopp, Chris O'Connor, Virginia Prescott, John Roberts, James Ross, Karen Schiffman, and Tim Skog. With help from Jane Manners, our senior producer is Graham Griffith. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.